And this will kind of give you the backdrop for the rest of the passage. So we're going to play it, and I'm going to narrate the video. It's just the instrumental clip. You can go ahead and leave the lights on. Yes. Thank you, though. Quick blip through the beginning of life from conception to birth. So right now, we don't have life. But as we go through the video, I'll kind of narrate how the days are turning into weeks and months. And feel free to interact with oohs and ahs and answer questions. Go ahead and ask. Okay. This past minute, there was no life, and soon we shall see the beginning of life. As you know, this is the what process? Very good! Fertilization process. And then, right now, there's life! So, all human chromosomes are present at this point, and we need human life again. The newly fertilized egg contains a staggering amount of genetic information sufficient to control the individual's growth and development for his entire lifetime. There's growth here because there is life. And long before a woman knows that she is pregnant, there is within her a living, growing human being. So right now, this is day 6. The embryo begins to implant itself in the uterus. At 14 days, the child will produce a hormone that suppresses the mother's menstrual period. It will be 2 more weeks before clear human features are discernible, but he is already a full-fledged member of the human race. Oh, or she. Okay. So guess what? What is this on the top, that line? What is that? That's the spine, right? Okay, then what's that? That red. That's the heart. So day 18, the heart is forming, and the heart is pumping blood throughout the entire body. By the end of week 3, the child's backbone, spinal column, and nervous system are forming. And then by day 22, you see the heart begin to beat. This is the child's own blood now, and it's often a different type than the mother, so completely unique from the mother. By day 28, the child has budding arms and legs, which you see. Oh, here you see the eyes forming first. And then a little arm sprouting. By week 5, eyes and legs and hands begin to develop. And then by week 6, brain waves are detectable, which is really unique because when we talk about end of life, brain waves are so important in determining life and death. But at week 6, the child has brain waves. At week 7, you see eyelids and the nose and the hands begin to develop. And then by week 8, every organ is in place and the bones are beginning to replace cartilage. You have to see fingerprints. That's okay, you have time. We see fingerprints beginning to form, and by the end of week 8, the baby can hear. And then week 9 and 10, the teeth begin to form inside the gum. You see fingernails develop. Week 10 and 11, the baby will start breathing in amniotic fluid and urinating. And then the baby can start to grasp objects placed in his hand, and all the organs and teeth are functioning. By week 12, this is very important, the baby has all the parts necessary to experience pain, including the nerves and spinal cord. By week 17, the baby can dream and go into REM sleep. By week 20, the baby can recognize the mother's voice. And then you go into month 5 and 6, where the baby practices inhaling amniotic fluid. The baby will grasp a umbilical cord when he feels it, and the mother can feel an increase of movement, kicking, and even pivot from the baby. And then you get into month 7 through 9, the baby will start to open and close his eyes. By this time, the baby is using 4 of the 5 senses, vision, hearing, taste, and touch. He'll know the difference between waking and sleeping and can relate to the moods of the mother. The baby's skin will begin to thicken and a layer of fat is produced and stored beneath the skin. Antibodies will be built up and the baby's heart begins to pump 300 gallons of blood per day. And then approximately 1 week before the birth, the baby will stop growing. And then people drop, usually head down into the pelvic cavity, and then you see him get ready to come out. And that's all 9 months. And then you get a baby!
Conversational. I don't think either of us have ever done a message with another person before. kind of tricky and kind of ambitious, so bear with us. Yeah, but we might even try to replicate some of the conversations that we've had while preparing this message. Okay, and then lastly, before we get started, I want to talk around this black velvet tea box. Inside. Okay, so inside there are some models of what a baby looks like at 7 weeks of pregnancy, 8 weeks, 9 weeks, oh, he's gonna fall. 9 weeks and 10 weeks. So we want this to be a very hands-on experience. We're gonna pass it around. Feel free to take as, well, not as much time as you want, but feel free to take some time to take them out so you can touch them, you know, interact with them. Those are, what is it called? Actual size. Yeah, and just feel free to just be in awe as you guys are interacting with these little replicas of human beings. And the crazy thing is, also keep in mind, 7 weeks to 10 weeks, this is the first trimester, is the most common time for abortions to take place, too. Okay, so just experience it, pray through it, let God keep you doing that, and just, you know, throughout the whole night, you know, you can just kind of circulate the room. Okay. So, the first picture we have. Okay, so to your left and to your right, so the left and right, are two very similar pictures. And it's also very interesting because these two pictures are both of babies who have spina bifida. And spina bifida is a disability, and it's something that actually, with more recent technology, it can be corrected while the baby's still in the womb. Usually around between 20 to 25 weeks, the surgeon can open up the womb and actually do a repair, and then close up the womb, and then the baby, you know, will actually be born, you know, 2 to 3 months later, which is pretty amazing. So these photos, the first one is to the left is of Sarah Marie Switzer, 24 weeks after conception, so mom was 6 months pregnant. And then the second one to the right was 21 weeks after conception. And the amazing thing about these were that as the surgeon was closing the womb, let's talk about the second one, the story behind the second one, the miracle happened. Baby Samuel, Armus, reached out his hand and grabbed the surgeon's finger. The photographer, whose name was Michael Clancy, caught this astonishing act on film. This was back in 1999. And in that instant, he went from being pro-choice to pro-life. He said, "I was totally in shock for 2 hours after the surgery. I know abortion is wrong now. It's absolutely wrong." And I think the one to the left is actually the photograph of the year on Life magazine. So we're just going to jump into the verses, and hopefully we'll have some fun doing this, okay? So verse 13, "For you form my inward part, you wove me in my mother's womb.
I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well.
My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth.
Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them.
How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them.
If I should count them, they would outnumber the sands. When I awake, I am still with you." So our goal is to kind of walk through each verse one by one, and we're going to start with verse 13. The words that Jenny and I, words that came to mind when we were studying this passage initially, and still presently, were words like intentionality, design, purpose, love, masterpiece, awe and wonder. Even from the beginning, every single human life was so intricately and personally made. One thing we noticed was, if you can count all the yous and yours between verses 13 and 16, there's about 7 of them. Go ahead and circle them if you want. And then there's another one in verse 17. So eight total of this. Oh, and then 18 is another one. So nine total in this whole thing. And then there's one commentator that says, he coins the term, this is called the divine involvement, where David is using the word you frequently just to emphasize how involved God is. Like, this happened, and you did this, and you did that. But he's right there with you, or right there with us, creating us. Everything about us was created, designed, and known by him. So in verse 13, there's kind of a quick dichotomy. First part is, you form my inward parts. The second is, you wove me in my mother's womb. It seems redundant, but we did a word study on the word inward. So you form my inward parts. And that word literally means kidney. So it's referring to the inmost being, like the soul or the spirit, the seat of the desires and affections. That's kind of like your personality, things that make you tick, things like that. And then the second half, you wove me in my mother's womb. That's referring to the more physical side of the body. But God is in charge of making both of these. Their spirit, the way you think, the things you delight in, and also the way that you look. I think oftentimes I think of it as either one or the other. You think of this specifically referring to disability and the physical way that you look, and so you tell yourself, well, I'm maybe God's image, but it's referring to both. And this kind of understanding and this kind of thinking of how God was so intentional leads to verse 14.
Okay, so verse 14 says, I will give thanks to you. Okay, let's stop there. I will give thanks to you. Other versions, like the NIV, say, I will praise you. So we looked up this word also. We had a lot of time with word studies. And this word literally, or give thanks or praise, that word literally means to hold out the hand, or to throw, or tap, or to revere with worship with extended hands. Kind of like these pictures. So, you know, often when you get excited about something, the first step is in your mind. You're like, whoa, that's really cool. And you tell yourself that in your mind. Now, if you're a little more excited than that, it might actually go from your mind to your lips and be like, Claire, this is so cool, right? So that's like the next level of, you know, awe, wonder, praise, excitement. And then if there's even more than that, it would not only come out of your lips, but it would also overcome your body. And that's when you might throw up your arms. Actually, the one on the left is the daughter of my former boss. She's a volleyball player, and that was their, like, championship game. So that wasn't like, okay, they're going to take a picture, let me pretend that I'm really excited. You know, but it's just kind of like when we're really overcome with emotion, we're really, you know, worshiping. We're constantly worshiping, right? It's just who we're worshiping and what we're worshiping. But something we really love will cause us to move our arms and actually overflow in that way. So an apple question for me was, when was the last time I was this expressive and overcome with excitement over who God is and what he has done? And yet this is what David is saying. He's saying, not just like, oh, I will give thanks to you, God, but it's like, I can't help but throw my arms up in unabandoned praise to you, God. Why? And then verse 14 continues, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Okay, so the word fearfully, actually some ancient versions read, for you are fearfully wonderful. So that's also interesting too. So the word fearfully, definition is inspiring reverence, inspiring godly fear, and awe. And then the word wonderfully, we learned that it's surpassing, distinct, marked out, distinguished, separate, set apart, which was actually surprising to us, because we thought, oh, wonderful, you know, like, wonderful is, like, amazing, right, but this has a very specific meaning to it. It almost reminded me of the word holy, because, you know, the word holy is, like, set apart, just kind of that idea. And so we were thinking, know, perhaps, you know, I mean, we're talking about human beings being fearfully and wonderfully made. You know, this is saying that while all creation is really wonderful, the human being is truly set apart from all other, you know, things that were created. What makes us distinct as humans? What makes us humans different from dogs, from birds, from trees? Do you guys have any, how about quickly, just a few things that you guys can think of that makes us different from animals? Words, language, right? There's no other animal that has language where they can communicate with each other. What else? We laugh and tell jokes. Humor, right? Real enjoyment of things. Definitely. But a couple more. The ability to reason or rational being. Right, that we can make decisions, that we can think through things. Mm-hmm. Well, one more. How about a guy? Huh? Art. Oh. Creativity. Yeah, it's not like you see dogs painting pictures, right? Or, I don't know. Birds do things, that's true. Yeah, but definitely creativity, and that's very much, you know, shows how we are made in God's image, because God is creative and artistic. Okay, and there's so much more. And also, lastly, we are moral beings, right? We know right and wrong. Animals don't have that sense of morality. And so it's not like animals can really sin either. I know that we should love God, and really glorify Him in a very intentional way the way we can. Okay, so, fearfully, wonderfully, all of these, you know, really inspire reference that shows that we're sort of distinct. And then, fearfully, wonderfully made. When I was looking at these words, I thought it was really interesting, because fearfully and wonderfully really, it kind of shows, you know, like, just how we are worthy of really, you know, certain respect, dignity, honor, because we're so unique and special and precious, right? And we have tremendous value and worth because we are made in the image of God. And then the word made is interesting because in the end, we're still made. As amazing creatures as we are, and how we, you know, we are very unique from the rest of creation, in the end, we are still creation. Only God was not made. He's the ultimate other, set apart in His own category. Dandra talked in the Sunday school class about sui generis, in a category of His own. And we are made in the image of God, and we're a shattered image at best, but God is the real thing. And so much of life is about learning to properly understand that delicate balance between fearfully, wonderfully, and made. You know, that I am precious, I am loved, I have tremendous value, and yet I'm not God. And when I try to be God, when I try to run my own life the way God should run my life, life spirals into disarray. This is called sin, and we hurt God as a result. And then also with people, the people God's placed in my life, my friends, my family, my neighbors, classmates, coworkers, that one person always gets on my nerves, you know, whoever it is, they are precious. They are beloved. They have tremendous value and worth. If we truly see them in this light, it would turn our lives and relationships upside down, and we would be radically different. That's a lot right there, that even I'm still thinking through right now. And this truth enables us to love even when we don't see a reason to love and when it feels like it's impossible to love. But when people are made in God's image, they have value, and so that gives us that reason to overcome what's humanly impossible. And yet, at the same time, that person is made. That person is God's beloved creation, but he is not God. And so to treat that person as God, again, life spirals into disarray. So we must know who we are and also know who we are not.
And then this distinction, the being fearfully and wonderfully and being made, we were thinking how a good way to keep ourselves in check is to kind of take the whole verse 14 together. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, and we have to give thanks to God. Both of those go hand in hand. If we separate the two and fail to give thanks to God, then we kind of fall into that like prideful, I am fearfully, wonderfully made, and then we either give ourselves too much value or give others too little value, one or the other. But if we can give thanks and also know that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, it keeps everything in check. So then the second part of that verse, it says, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, and then it says, wonderful are your works. And when we did a word study on the two different wonderfuls, we realized that they're actually two different words. Wonderful are your works, that's our common understanding of what wonderful is. Something that's marvelous, extraordinary, of distinguished quality. So one of the questions that we were pondering was whether King David says, wonderful are your works, as a subjective statement or as an objective statement. And we were thinking that it might be a little bit of both. David is probably reflecting on humans and how we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and expressing his thanks there and saying that he believes that wonderful are God's works. But superior to that is an objective statement. King David is stating that God's works are wonderful. And it's not based on just the fact that humans are so unique, but it's a reflection on who God is. He can say wonderful are your works because he's saying wonderful are you. It's not just a statement about man, although it could be a reflection of man is wonderful, but ultimately it declares that God is wonderful. So there's kind of a little bit of both, but I think even the King David would get, he would tell us, I do believe that humans are wonderful, but objectively, God is wonderful, therefore wonderful are your works.
And if God is wonderful, then how can someone who is wonderful not produce wonderful work? Like he does what is consistent with his character. And we're so used to thinking about wonderful as a subjective term, right? Like, oh, I think that boba from Spotify is wonderful, right? Very feeling-based. But if indeed wonderful are your works is really objective, then it doesn't, yeah, it's not dependent on how we feel. So this is saying that God defines and decides what is wonderful. You guys, does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So for me, an immediate application, when I come to realize that God is saying, I'm going to decide and define what wonderful means, regardless of what you feel. Some of you guys might know, I work in a children's hospital. I work in the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit. Lots of really sick babies, and lots of babies who are born with special needs and various disabilities, deformities, congenital abnormalities, whatever you call it. And so these are pictures currently I have at least one baby with each of these diagnoses currently, actually. The top one is holoprosencephaly. That's where your brain doesn't divide properly, so it doesn't really form two sides of the brain, so then everything in the brain and also in the facial features is kind of all converging towards the middle. And that baby also has a club lip, too. Down here, the baby has club feet, and I work with babies, you know, making hand braces and foot braces, especially if their hands and feet are not in alignment, to kind of prevent further contractions. The top middle is such a long term, but I do have a baby who has his hands do look like that right now, and they call it like a lobster claw syndrome. So that was actually when I was working with that baby, Psalm 139 was like running through my mind, just like, I've always known Psalm 139, right? But then it really challenged whether or not necessarily believe it when I work with a baby with hands that look like that. And then down here, the baby has hydrocephalus. That's where the fluid builds up in the brain. And I work with a baby with hydrocephalus to work on breastfeeding. It's kind of how do you position a baby to breastfeed when the head is so big and really tricky. And then that baby has a cleft lip and a cleft palate. So I'm working with them on how to drink from a bottle when there's a huge opening and you can't really suck milk out because there's, you know, there's air going through the hole. And then the last one in the corner is gastroschisis, and that's a condition where the intestines form outside of the body. And actually, that's a pretty common condition that we see at the hospital. I was actually really surprised that I didn't know about it until I started working at the hospital. And so eventually, at some point, they reinsert the intestines back into the baby's body. But before they do that, we have to make space in the stomach. So while they're trying to move things around the stomach, they put all the intestines in a bag called a silo, and they hang it over the baby's body, you know, over the baby. And so this bag hanging in the air, and it has all their intestines in it. So when I do... Yeah. It's really trippy. So when I see these babies and I hold them at work and I care for them, the words that seem to stare me in the face are mistake, defect, accident, deformity. Poor baby, something must have gone terribly wrong. Yes.
What is the
feeling
bad
with?
What is the feeling bad
with
your
body
making at the hospital?
Yeah, so these babies are born with, yeah, it looks like something is wrong with their body when they're born. But God, we're talking about how God made them that way. Yeah, and so as I see these pictures and I see these babies at work, Psalm 139 tells me that these babies are wonderful and that God's work is wonderful. Even if I don't feel it. And this is huge, right? Imagine being a parent and you're just looking at your baby like, what is happening? Your whole world is crashing down. But for me, it certainly doesn't look wonderful or feel wonderful. And I don't find myself explaining, wow, wonderful are your works, God, when I'm seeing these babies and their challenges. But objectively, it is true. So, you know, and that's what the Bible teaches. That's theology. Doctrine. So I'm thinking about how like doctrine and theology are kind of like a map. They tell you the way things are, and they guide us in life, right? And if I were to take a map and just like rub my face into it and memorize every single detail of the map, let's say I memorize, I don't know, the map of Alhambra, I can tell you where every single intersection is and the name of every single street, and I know this map inside and out, right? Just because I've done that doesn't mean I've actually experienced Alhambra. I haven't actually gone to Blockheads to eat their shaved snow. You know, I haven't actually, you know, experienced the crazy Chinese drivers honking at me on the streets or like getting yelled at when you need dim sum. Right? That's like experiencing it. But just to know the map, you know, is nowhere near the actual experience. So likewise, it's one thing to know doctrine intellectually, and it's another thing to experience that truth in a way that actually affects our hearts. And I mean, most of us are all church kids. We know this is our struggle. This is our challenge. That we know all these things in our head, but perhaps our hearts are not affected by it yet. Our minds are engaged, but our emotions are not, you know, inflamed. And so David here in verse 14 says, wonderful are your works, objectively, right? He says, and my soul knows it very well. He didn't say my mind knows it really well, but my soul, and I know it really well all the way down to the deepest part of who I am. So do we see God's work as wonderful, and do we truly believe and know it in the very core of who we are? This phrase, wonderful are your works, is rooted, like Clara said, in the fact that God himself is wonderful. So essentially, wonderful are your works, because my soul knows you very well. And you, who are wonderful, make wonderful works. And the assurance of these facts are rooted and grounded in the character of God.
I think when we first looked at this, it seemed kind of daunting. Like, the question that we asked was, can you only say this if you are a really mature Christian? Can you only say one for your works, my soul knows it very well, if you are like, have been a Christian for 20 years or something? But what we were thinking was, our capacity to understand and appreciate God's wonderfulness grows with us. So for a young budding Christian, brand new to the faith, to say, my soul knows full well that God's works are wonderful, can be true, because to the capacity and understanding that they have of God's character, they do understand full well that God is wonderful. But then as they grow and they mature and their capacity to understand God's character grows with that more and more, then they can still say, my soul knows full well that God's works are wonderful, and it's also true. So both Christians, the young and the old, can give the same claim, and there's equal truth to both claims, but it may be different. The difference is the depth of their understanding. That gave us great comfort. Verse
15. Okay, so going on to verse 15. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret. So I'm going to stop right there. Let's watch this video actually. Oh wait, it's in double speed.
Sorry, slow down a little bit. Okay, so as you know, that is an ultrasound, and that is a way for parents to see what their baby looks like before the baby is born. And technology is pretty amazing, right? And even now, there's even technology is always getting more and more advanced. And now there's 4D high definition ultrasounds where you can get a clearer picture of what the baby looks like. But as amazing as that is, is that a very clear picture of what the baby looks like in the womb? No, right? At a certain point, you can tell if it's a boy or a girl, right? Because they'll look for certain features. But even that, it can convey false information because, you know, they might tell you it's a girl because they don't, you know, see the features of a boy, but maybe it was just at the wrong angle and they didn't see it, and then you make a whole pink nursery with, you know, you buy your baby little dresses and bows, and then comes out and it's a little boy.
Did that happen with the manual?
No, it happened to my sister-in-law, Audrey, or one of Audrey, but they were having a girl and then the baby.
There we go. So, case in point. So, the verse says, but our full frame was not hidden from God. Right? Even in the womb, God knows exactly what we look like. And then, as amazing as it is to look at an ultrasound and to see a baby moving like that, to see the heart beating, and parents get super excited when they see that, right? The view is still so limited. The ultrasound is nothing like the real thing. Because this is what God actually sees. So that was baby Hannah in the ultrasound, which looks nothing like baby Hannah here or there. So only God knew that Hannah would have Robert's ears, that she would have Kathy's eyebrows, that she would make all these funny facial expressions, because truly the womb is that secret place where only God sees everything. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret.
Okay. Also, when I was thinking about this phrase, when I was in secret, when we look at the word frame, it literally means bone. So my bones were not hidden from you. You know, the way my body was structured, the way, you know, even some people have missing bones. Some people are double jointed. Some people are born very little. Some people are born with very broad shoulders, you know, big or small. Our bones are not hidden from God. And this reminds me of when I got to observe and witness something really cool. Let me mute it. Who knows what that is?
Heart.
Uh-huh. What about the heart? What is that? What are you actually seeing here? Who said that open heart surgery? Brilliant! Yes, this is an open heart surgery. Crazy, huh? I know. Okay, some of you guys might have to stop looking at what you're doing. So I got to witness an actual open heart surgery where I was literally like a foot away from the heart. So I was standing above the patient's head and like looking over, and the surgeon was performing the heart surgery. And just seeing this, it was a mitral valve repair for those of you who know who that is, know what that is. But seeing this female patient's chest wall cut open like that, her breastbone clawed down the middle, seeing her heart actually pumping blood, you guys see that? It was quivering and pumping, and the heart, when it pumps in an upward spiral motion. And I was like, oh, that's what my textbook said. It's actually true. Seeing that right before my eyes, it was almost godlike. Like, I'm not supposed to be seeing this. Only God is supposed to see this kind of stuff, right? So you'll see parts of her body that even she herself has never seen. It's actually kind of creepy. And she never will see, right? Because she was knocked out, like completely sedated during that surgery. There's a certain intimacy in that moment when I realized that I had a view to, to this intimate secret space of which only God truly knows the inner workings are. And then actually in those days following the surgery, I got to work with the patient. And I was like, dude, you're still alive after that? and I was a therapist, I got to work with her on getting back on her feet, you know, being able to dress herself and eventually go home from the hospital. And it was weird, it was eerie to talk to her, to interact with her, while knowing that I'd seen the inside of her body. It's almost like a, I don't know, magic school bus. and I know certain things about her heart that she doesn't even know. And then it hit me, wow, this is how God knows me. He knows certain things about my heart that I don't even know. He sees things about my heart that I'm totally not even aware of. Even for a surgeon, their knowledge and attitude is very much like a technician, like a mechanic. Like, oh, this part of the car broke down, let me fix it. Oh, this part, the mitral valve is not working properly, let me, you know, repair it and switch it out. Oh, let me, you know, bring in another vein so that blood can run through, you know, when it's getting all clotted and stuff like that. But for God, yeah, I mean, he does have the knowledge of a surgeon, very technical, very detailed, but it's also extremely personal and extremely relational, and it's filled with love. His knowledge of us is filled with love. He knows us inside and out, knows us way better than we know ourselves, and it's mind-blowing, right? It's mind-blowing to imagine God as that master craftsman, skillfully forming us down to every single little detail, in secret, where only he knows the intricacies of our bodies in secret.
So in verse 15 we have that our frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. So we did a word study on skillfully wrought, and this word refers to like needlework, embroidery, usually referring to a tapestry. Other translations of this particular phrase is intricately woven or curiously woven, where there's that sense of wonder and mystery when God is knitting us or rocking us together. And then this kind of carries that same essence of him making our inward parts and forming us in our mother's womb.
Okay, so Ravi Zacharias, he has a book titled The Grand Weaver, and he tells a story in this book. Okay. So I'm going to read this to you, so do your best to check out what I'm saying here. Some time ago, I had the privilege to speak at a conference at Johns Hopkins University on the theme, What Does It Mean to Be Human? Before my address, Francis Collins, who is the director of the Human Genome Project and the co-mapper of human DNA, presented his talk. He spoke of the intelligibility and marvel of the Book of Life, filled with more than 3 billion bits of information. In a strange way, he became both the subject and the object of his study, both the designer and the design of his research. Extraordinary thoughts formed within me as I listened, virtually tuning in and out of the talk in order to reflect on the wonder of it all. In his last slide, he showed 2 pictures side by side. On the left appeared a magnificent photo of the stained glass rose window from York Minster Cathedral in Yorkshire, England. Its symmetry radiating from the center, as you can see, its colors and geometric patterns are spectacular, clearly a work of art purposefully designed by a gifted artist. Its sheer beauty stirs the mind. Agree? Now, on the right side of the screen appeared a slide showing a cross-section of a strand of, who knows what that is, so I guess I'm on there. Of human DNA. So you know double helix? That's like if you're looking down into the double helix along the axis. The picture did more than take one breath. It was awesome in the profoundest sense of the term. Not just beautiful, but overwhelming. And it almost mirrored the pattern of the rose window in Yorkminster. The intricacy of the DNA's design that pointed to the transcendent one astonished those who are themselves the design and who have been created semi-transcendent by design. We see ourselves only partially, but through our Creator's eyes, we see our transcendence. In looking at our own DNA, the subject and the object came together. The audience gasped at the sight, for it saw itself. The design, the colors, the splendor of the design left everyone speechless, even though it is this very design that makes us capable of speech. Because of this design, we can think in profound ways, but we felt paralyzed by the thought and could go no further. Because of that design, we remain trapped in time, but were momentarily lifted to the eternal. Because of that design, we were capable of love and suddenly can see the loveliness of who we are. We can map out a human genome and in it see the evidence of a great cartographer or map maker. We can plan and now see a great planner. We can sing and now see poetry in matter. We speculate and see the intricacies of purpose. We live, seeing the blueprint of life, and we die, but we can look through the keyhole of life. At Johns Hopkins that day, we saw the handiwork of the one who made us for himself. Incredible, huh?
So in light of this, our frame was not hidden from God when we were made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. God has seen our unformed substance, and in God's book were written all the days that were ordained for us, and yet there was not one of them. Other translations have, every day of my life was recorded in your book, every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. For in thy book all my numbers were written, which in continuance were fashioned when as yet there was not one of them. So this particular verse has really brought me so much more comfort now in my workplace than I guess my memory of it was before. And I think specifically it's the word ordained, that all the days of our life were ordained even before there was yet one of them. For me, death is always unplanned. It's always unexpected. And I work in hospice, so I work with people who pass away. But even then, I have my set schedule of patients, then either I'll see them and tell the family that the patient will pass away soon, or I'm the one that has to get the call in the middle of the day to pronounce someone has passed away. And either way, it's always jarring. It's always unexpected. It's always sudden. It's always an interruption, even if it's expected. Even just this past week, when I wrote this, I had just pronounced someone as dead, but this past week there were four other lines that passed away, and it's just, it never gets any easier, and for me, death is always that kind of jarring interruption, but here, it says that it was ordained. This word ordained means to form, to predetermine, to purpose. So it's used a lot in the creation story when God is ordaining creation. It's also used a lot in Isaiah when it refers to the potter and clay analogy, that the potter ordains whatever shape for the clay. And for me, this idea is that God is not only knowledgeable of our life and death, although he is, but he reaches his hands into our lives, and he fashions us in our life and in our death. Both of them are equally as purposeful. Because this verse, or this half of the verse, could just as easily have read, in your book were written the days that were for me. And that would be sufficient to prove God's omniscience, right? He already knows, and so he knows all, so that makes sense. But David adds in the words, ordained for me, so, and in your book were written all the days that were ordained for me. And it makes God more intimate with us. It seems to change the whole sentence from, like, this knowing, indifferent statement, just a powerful, but separate statement, to something that's like a promise, and it's very compassionate. I have ordained these days for you. It's like God is saying, to me at least, do not worry about when your time of death or your loved one's time of death, your parents or whoever, when their time of death is yet to come. I've already prepared that way for you and for them. And it's been fashioned and molded even before you were born, even before Hannah was born. God had already ordained her entire life. And for us, it's a little, I guess more specific, but even for us as we are growing, he's fashioning us in our life, in where we are, where we go to school, and what we're going to do, all the way to the end. That's very, very promising to me. When we were thinking more about the word, we also thought that ordained is another word that grows with you. So as a child, one might think, a child might think, God ordained my meals for me. So the capacity that they understand, you know, they have freedom of day, and God ordains that. And then as a teenager, God ordains the friends that we make from year to year. So he's in charge of, you know, our interactions and such. As a high schooler, God ordains our likes and dislikes, our college applications, where we get accepted, where we don't get accepted, things like that. Then, as a young adult, God ordains our job opportunities, our relationships, who we will marry. It's a little bigger. And then as an adult, God ordains our families, our children, our finances, our homes, our aging parents. And then as an elderly folk, God ordains our grandchildren, our caretakers, our aging bodies, and ultimately our death. And in between any one of these stages, God may ordain any one of us to come home at any point in time. A high schooler who was swallowed up by their own depression, an innocent hiker who took one wrong footing just a couple months before her high school graduation, two brothers who were sleeping at night who were brutally beaten to death by an enraged uncle. Is it possible for our loving God to have ordained all of these circumstances? Psalms 139:16 gives us a resounding yes, and these real circumstances did not take our God by surprise. He carefully ordained all this to come to pass. Because our loving God is also our suffering God. And so there's this book called When God Weeps by Johnny Arcantara and Stephen Estee. And I'm going to read, there's a whole chapter that's a unique narration of the life and death of Jesus, but I'm just going to read the last portion of the chapter. So at this point, Jesus has already been born. He endured the temptation of Satan in the wilderness. He performed many miracles. He preached repentance. He ate the Last Supper. He's in the Garden of Gethsemane. He already prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. And then the torches arrived. The sheep fled. The shepherds stood. And the hurricane struck. Up Skull Hill to the welcome of other poorly paid legionnaires enjoying themselves marched Jesus. On your back with you, a soldier raises a mallet to sink in the spike, and as the man swings, the son recalls how he and the father first designed the medial nerve of the human forearm, the sensations it would be capable of. The design proved flawless. The nerve performed exquisitely. Up you go, they declare. They lift up the cross. God is now on display in his underwear and can scarcely breathe. But these pains are a mere warm-up to his other and growing dread. He begins to feel a foreign sensation. Somewhere during this day, an unearthly foul odor begins to waft, not around his nose, but his heart. He feels dirty. Human wickedness starts to crawl upon his spotless being, the living excrement from our souls. The apple of his father's eye turns brown with rot. And his father, Jesus must face his father like this. From heaven, the father now rouses himself like a lion disturbed, shakes his mane, and roars against the shriveling remnant of a man hanging on a cross. Never has the son seen the father look at him so, never felt even the least of his hot breath. But the roar shakes the unseen world and darkens the visible sky. And the son does not recognize these eyes. God declares, Son of man, why have you behaved so? You have cheated, lusted, stolen, gossiped, murdered, envied, hated, lied. You have cursed, robbed, overspent, overeaten, fornicated, disobeyed, embezzled, and blasphemed. Oh, the duties you have shirked, the children you have abandoned, who has ever so ignored the poor, so played the coward, so belittled my name? Have you ever held your razor tongues? What a self-righteous, pitiful drug, you who molest young boys, peddle killer drugs, travel in cliques, and mock your parents. Who gave you the boldness to rig elections, foment revolutions, torture animals, and worship demons? And does the list never end? Splitting families, raping virgins, acting smugly, playing the pimp, buying politicians, practicing extortion, filming pornography, accepting bribes. You have burned down buildings, perfected terrorist tactics, founded false religions, and traded in slaves, relishing each morsel and bragging about it all. I loathe these things in you. Disgust for everything about you consumes me. Can you not feel my wrath? And of course the son is innocent. He's blamelessness itself. The father knows this, but the divine pair have an agreement, and the unthinkable must now take place. Jesus will be treated as if personally responsible for every sin committed. The Father watches as his heart's treasure, the mirror image of himself, sink, drowning into raw liquid sin. Jehovah's stored rage against humankind from every century explodes in a single direction. And Jesus cries, Father, Father, Why have you forsaken me? But heaven stops its ears. The sun stares up at the one who cannot, who will not reach down or refine. The Trinity has planned it. The Son endured it. The Spirit enabled him. The Father rejected the Son whom he loved. Jesus, the God-man from Nazareth, perished. God accepted his sacrifice for sin and was satisfied. The rescue was accomplished. God stepped down his throne. And this is who asks us to trust him when he calls on us to suffer.
Second Timothy 1:12, Paul says, "For this reason I also suffer these things, but I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed, and I am convinced that he is able to guard what I have entrusted him until that day." When we know who it is that calls us to suffer, it makes all the difference, right? He doesn't just give us the answers to all these hard issues and questions of life. He could, but he gives us himself, and he is the answer. And because we know him as our suffering God, our wonderful God, because of that, we can call all of his works, every single one of them, as wonderful. Verse 17, move on. It says, "How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand." At first glance, this seems a bit random, kind of like a change in topic. We just spent all the time talking about how God formed us so intimately, he created us in our mother's tummies, and all of a sudden it's like, oh God, your thoughts are so precious, there's so many of them. Is this now expanding and broadening to all of God's thoughts? Like, he must have a lot of them, right? As he runs the entire universe. So we were asking ourselves that question as we were studying this. But then we realized that this is coming off the heels of verses 13 to 16, of God's extremely personal involvement with each of our lives. So this is referring specifically to the thoughts that God has concerning me. David is mulling over the fact that God knew him and thought of him, and that God's thoughts toward him were thoughts of love. And how many thoughts must God have toward me to uniquely design my body, to sustain my life, to keep my heart beating every single moment, to fashion my personality, to ordain my relationships, my circumstances, my joy, my struggles, to plan out every single moment of my life, my past, my present, my future. How many thoughts is that? We cannot conceive, I think it's Matthew Henry who said, we cannot conceive how many God's kind counsels have been concerning us, how many good turns he has done us, and what variety of mercies we have received from him. If we would count them, the heads of them, much more the particulars of them, they are more in number than the sand, and every single one great and very considerable. We cannot conceive the multitude of God's compassions, which are all new every morning. And I'm just thinking, if I just think about how many thoughts God has concerning me, providing for me, ordaining every single thing about my life, and I'm just one person. I'm just one out of 7.4 billion people who are on this earth. And those thoughts concerning me are more than the specks of sand on one beach. That would be like 7.4 billion beaches, right? For God to have so many thoughts to provide for so many people all at the same time. Let alone animals, planets, the whole universe. No wonder David says, how vast is the sum of them. And now, we all thought this was kind of funny. Like, if David is informing God, like, wow, God, you have a lot of thoughts. Like,
And God's like, really? I do, huh? Why is he telling God that? God obviously knows. Or is it just like a factual statement? Like, oh, there's, I don't know, God has a lot of thoughts, period. I don't know.
We also thought that it might be like contradictory, like how vast are your thoughts to me? But if I were to count them, if you were to count them, are they unlimited or are they actually vast or not? But it seems like David must have no actual real intention to count all these thoughts. It's more of like an expression of awe, like a human person here validation of how vast God's thoughts are. We looked at outnumber, the word outnumber, and the word has like this multiplying effect. So King David is not just saying that God's thoughts are large, like there's this big finite number and God has many of them, but rather God's thoughts are always multiplying and increasing exponentially. So it's like on Mother's Day when we try to rack up all the things that we are thankful for, that our moms do for us, and we're trying to give a count and give thanks to all of them. But so we say, thank you for everything you've done. You've done innumerable things for me. It's kind of like that. I know you're going to keep doing great things for me, and if I were to count them, there would be too many of them, and they keep multiplying. So it's kind of that effect, outnumbering the sand.
Yeah, so again, this is a very relational expression of appreciation to God. And this is why David says, how precious are your thoughts to me. It's full of affection, full of appreciation. He's telling God how much he loves him and treasures him. And yes, when we think about God and his thoughts, we must think of them with a great deal of reverence. And yet it means so much more when we actually enjoy them. We take the time to delight in them, to find pleasure in thinking about the ways that God is thinking about us. He wants us to.
It also says, there's these two parts in verse 17, how precious are your thoughts to me, and how vast are the sum of them. So another commentator talked about the vastness and preciousness of God's thoughts. For us humans, vastness and preciousness are inversely correlated. If you have something that's very precious, it's because it's rare and there's not a lot of them, there's few of them. And then when there's a lot of something, when something's very vast, it's very cheap. But because God is infinite, he can have a vast number of thoughts and all of them be infinitely precious too. So both of those don't go against each other, but they kind of compound each other. That's part of God's character. And when we looked at the whole of verse 13 to 18, there seems to be two sections, like 13 and 14, and you form me in the inner parts, you will be in my mother's womb, and I will give thanks. So it's like theology and then doxology. I will thank you for it. So when we were reading verse 15 through 18, we thought that there would kind of be that same pattern. My frame was not hidden from you, your eyes were in my unformed substance, and your book was written all the days that were ordained for me. It's theology, and then we expect doxology after that. And then we were kind of rereading 17 and 18, and it still does make sense. This is David's doxology that follows this theology of who God is. The doxology in verses 17 to 18 is how David is praising God for his vastness, his dedication to detail, his continual presence. This second part, this doxology, is not simply affirming truth about God to God, that his thoughts are precious and that there's a lot of thoughts, that God's thoughts are vast, but it's also relishing the love of God with God, because it's talking to him. How precious are your thoughts? It's kind of coming alongside God and worshiping God with God. And David is able to do this. He's able to worship God rightly because he has an accurate understanding of God and a humble understanding of himself, the both of them. So we were thinking, for us, how does our understanding of God cause us to give doxology to Him? Or the other way around, if we're not giving doxology to Him, what does that say about our understanding of God? If we're not praising Him with our lives and worshiping Him. Then the end of verse 18, David says, "When I awake, I am still with you." And this was maybe the outlier in the verse. We didn't know where it came from or what it was referring to. But one thing we did look up was the word "still," and it says, "I am still with you." And this "still" is not a static kind of "still," like God is just with you side by side, He's just there. Still is a continual, repeated, again, going round and round kind of word. It's not that God just sits next to us for all of time and eternity. Rather, the connotation is very dynamic. God is repeatedly, again and again, with us at this particular time, and then in the next moment, and then in the next. And the only reason why God can do this kind of continual stillness is because He's a timeless God. So He can be with us at all these times, repeatedly, continuously, again and again, and such. He's the past, the present, and the future all sit before Him, and He can be fully present in all three tenses. God is still dynamically, continuously, repeatedly. He is still with us. And I think instead of this just being another statement, this is David's way of expressing another characteristic of God, His timelessness there.
And this really appears to be consistent with verse 2, which Rebecca walked us through. "You know when I sit down and when I rise up," and how God is constant and present at all times, and how Candace talked about how God is omnipresent. "When I awake in the morning, I'm still with you. When I awake, I'm under your eye, under your watch, under your care, under your protection." Again, Matthew Henry says, "This bespeaks also the continual devout sense David had of the eye of God upon him. When I awake, I am with thee in my thoughts. And it would help to keep us in the fear of the Lord all day long if, when we awake in the morning, our first thoughts were of Him, and we did then set Him before us." And again, kind of like Rebecca was saying, that can be a very scary thing, right? To have someone constantly, like, staring at you. But when you wake up in the morning, God's eye is on you. It can also be a very comforting thing, depending on what your relationship with God is. To live each moment in God's presence and under God's watch. That's also kind of what comes to mind when you're saying this verse.
I think to wrap things up, we were thinking, there's so many different ways to apply this, and we will take this into our small group in a couple of weeks. But one of the big things we wanted to, or at least that we came away with, is an accurate understanding of the way things work in the world. So the danger of our day is to look horizontally around us and abide by the expectations that society places on our self-inflated worth, or the deflated worth of those who are less capable. And so when we look around us first, and we set our standard at where society sets the standard, when we do that, we inadvertently place our identity in what society deems as valued. And in doing so, we make our God very, very small and puppet-like. But according to Psalms 139, we are to do the exact opposite. We must first understand who God is. And that's what all of Psalms 139, 1 through 18 is talking about, all of God's characteristics. And in understanding who God is, and understanding Him and who God is, In understanding God for who He is, the natural product is a response of right doxology, which is what David did. Right doxology regarding the nature of God and the nature of man. So that dichotomy of us being fearfully and wonderfully made, and then getting fixed to God, having that balance. And then when we know who God is and we put our identity in who He is because we are made in His image, then the byproduct of that is a godly attitude towards others. So the outworking, the biblical outworking of our character has to follow this pattern. A growing knowledge of God, then an accurate identity in Christ, and then a loving outpouring of the Holy Spirit towards others, as opposed to the other way around. This is what Psalms 139 is calling us to do. To not follow the leading of the world today, but instead to look heavenward first, to seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and then allow our thoughts and actions to flow from a correct understanding of God in us out towards others.
Okay, so we're going to end with a video. And as you guys watch the video, we wanted you to think about a few questions. Questions are, what do these verses tell us about who God is? What do they tell us about who we are? And how to view and treat those around us? And what difference would it make if we see ourselves and our fellow image bearers as fearfully and wonderfully made? So just think about how, if we really kind of understand these verses, how would that change the way we live our lives? We can hit the light, so.
You have searched me, Lord, and you know me.
You know where I sit?
Right on right.
You go see me on the top.
I will turn myself out and I will down.
You must believe me without my name.
This won't ruin it, not my tongue.
You're good, you must be.
And then if you go to my mother's womb, I praise you.
What your word has to say about who we are, both inside and outside, in our spirit, and also our physical body. We just thank you so much for being so close to us, for loving us, for creating us so intricately and delicately and curiously, and for not only ordaining our lives, but also being present in our death. We thank you for the comfort that is found in knowing that we are yours. And we pray that as we continue to relish over these few verses and ponder what it is that you've done for us, that you would give us humbleness in our hearts, a right understanding of who you are, so that we would be able to live rightly before you and before others. I just thank you again for the time. I do pray all these things in Jesus' name.